I want to read to you our text. It's found in Luke chapter 16. We're looking at beliefs, teachings that Jesus taught, teachings that were instrumental in the bulk of his ministry, and that we ought not lose among us. This morning, we're looking at the doctrine of hell, Luke chapter 16, verse 19 through 31. There was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. But there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, full of sores, who was laid at his gate, desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. So it was that the beggar died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died and was buried. And being in torments in Hades, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. And then he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. But Abraham said, Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, likewise Lazarus' evil things, but now he is comforted and you are tormented. And besides all this, between us and you there is a great gulf fixed, so that those who want to pass from here to you cannot, nor can those from there pass to us. And then he said, I beg you, therefore, Father, that you would send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may testify to them, lest they also come to this place of torment. Abraham said to him, They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. And he said, No, Father Abraham, but if one goes to them from the dead, they will repent. But he said to him, If they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rise from the dead. Well, you know the questions, don't you? How could a loving God create a place like hell? How could a loving God send people to hell? I mean, doesn't it feel like a cosmic overreach? The things that we do, what in the world could we do that would deserve eternal punishment in hell? Doesn't it seem like a cosmic overreach, a cosmic overcorrection to have a place like hell? It doesn't make any sense that a loving God, a God of mercy, a God of grace, would even create a place like that, let alone let people go to a place of torment. You've heard those kinds of questions, you've heard those kinds of issues. And so what I'd like to do this morning is talk to you from this passage about hell, and I'd like to mention three or four things that I think are paramount in this passage. And the first thing that I'd like to mention is that according to this passage, hell is a real place. I mean, it is a real place. This passage, some people think, is a parable. There's some debate whether this is an actual account or Jesus is telling a parable. Those who think it is a parable say that it sort of has the qualities of a parable. It sort of sits up like a parable. It sort of has a point that would be reminding them of a parable. But those who say, well, it's not a parable, but that it's a literal or a literal account, but no parable has some of the qualities of this account of Jesus. For instance, there's a man with a name, and there isn't another parable that Jesus told where a person has a name. You have a man named Lazarus. You have Abraham mentioned in this parable. So whether or not it's a parable, whether or not Jesus is telling a story about hell, or whether he's giving a literal account of what he knew had happened in the life of two individuals, regardless of that, what we do know is that in the teaching of Jesus, At least 20 times Jesus mentions and references hell. And there may be more depending on how you count. Now, let me bore you royally for just a minute. In the King James Version, and it would vary from version to version, we have 41,522 words of Jesus. I didn't count all that, but that's what people say. 41,522 words of Jesus. Average person speaks 120 to 160 words a minute. You do the math, we have roughly about 5 hours worth of Jesus' teaching recorded. In other words, you ought to be able to read all the red letters in your King James Version in about 5 hours, give or take. Jesus references hell at least 20 times, maybe more, but at least 20 times. Now, that means on average, 20 times, 5 hours worth of his teaching, he references hell on an average of every 15 minutes. Now, that's far more than most preachers would reference hell. I don't think, and I'm almost certain, I don't reference hell every 15 minutes I'm on this platform. That's far more than modern preaching references hell. I mean, if you had a conference, and maybe it's a work conference, and you go, it's Saturday, starts at 9, ends at 2, and the speaker of that conference who's leading it references a concept every 15 minutes, 20 times in the course of 5 hours on Saturday, you would say, it's a significant concept. It's something that I ought to be aware of. And so I think the fact that Jesus references it so much ought to tell us that it's serious. It was in the front of his thinking. He wants to put it in our thinking. It's a real place, and it's something that you and I ought to be concerned about. So it's a real place. Secondly, it's a place that he doesn't want you to go. Okay, it's a place that he doesn't want you to go. It's interesting here in verse 25 that Abraham, who is sort of at least the representative of God, he's a representative of heaven, he says to the rich man, he says, son. Do you see the kindness that Abraham is showing this man, even who is in hell because of his sins? He's chosen to be there, and we'll get to that in a minute. But even at that, he says, son. Son. And that's a kind word. He doesn't say, you terrible person, why are you talking to me? He doesn't say, you deserve everything that you've got. There's a kindness. Abraham says, son. I mean, listen. Hear me, he says. Ezekiel 33:11, God is talking to the people, and he says, I take no joy when the wicked die. He says, I don't enjoy it when the wicked die. That doesn't thrill me. That doesn't bring any contentment to me. I take no pleasure when the wicked perish. Now, that's what God is saying. So it's a real place, and God doesn't want you to ever go there. Jesus doesn't want you to ever go there. And it's a place, because it's real, because God doesn't want you to go there, that you ought to take every effort to avoid going to. Take every effort to avoid going to hell. I mean, why? And why wouldn't you, why don't you want to go to hell? And it's easy to say, well, because it's a really hot place. And I like snow. You know, it's easy to say, well, the reason I wouldn't want to go to hell is, I mean, look at the physical pain. It's a lake of fire. It's a place of torment. Physically, I wouldn't want to go because it's going to be brutal. And that's probably maybe true. It's interesting that most commentators, even most conservative commentators, think that the picture of hellfire is probably figurative. A lot of commentators think that has been very much in Church of God thinking. Probably the two most influential theologians in the Church of God were a guy named Russell Byram and another guy named F.G. Smith. And in both of their writings, they're very adamant that the hellfire is figurative. It's not literal fire, but it's pointing to something else. Billy Graham, who is not a heretic, has always preached that it's figurative, not literal flame. So it's not a literal fire, but it's pointing to something other than that. But even at that, I think Jonathan Edwards' words ought to be heeded by us. Edwards was perhaps the greatest American preacher to ever live. He was a great writer. He started the First Great Awakening. It was his preaching. Very gifted man. In fact, Yale University named Jonathan Edwards, and you know Yale isn't particularly sympathetic to Christians, right? Yale named Jonathan Edwards the third greatest mind America ever produced, after Edison and after Thomas Jefferson. So when Yale, which is not a Christian place, says this preacher was the third greatest mind America ever produced, he was a magnificent man, a magnificent leader of the kingdom, magnificent preacher. And he says this, he said, after reading the whole Bible, he said, I am convinced that the flames of hell are figurative. He said, but understand that a metaphor in the Bible always points to something worse than the metaphor. What Edwards then is saying is that hellfire is bad, but if it's figurative, what it points to is actually worse than the fire. Okay. And I think that's important for you to see. If it is figurative, and I'm not saying it is figurative, I mean, there may be hellfire there. But if it is a metaphor, if it is figurative, just understand that when the Bible has a metaphor or something figurative, it always points to something worse than the thing it's representing. I mean, most people think the imagery of heaven, for instance, is figurative. The streets of gold, the pearls, those kinds of things. That comes from Revelation. There's a lot of figures. There's a lot of symbolism there. We know that Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 that he ascended into heaven and God told him he couldn't tell anybody what he saw. So you can make the point that we really don't know what heaven's like because Paul saw and God said you can't tell anybody what you saw. It's not legal for them to know what heaven's like yet. And so you have the symbolism in heaven, you have the gold streets and such, but if you have gold streets in heaven, gold wouldn't be a symbol for brick. I mean, if you say it's symbolic, you have to say the gold and the pearls and the jewels, that's the most wonderful thing we know, and heaven is far greater than what we can imagine. That's the imagery. That's what the imagery would point towards. So if you say that hell's like a fire, you don't say, well, it's really like a flame. It would have to point to something far worse, far more significant than what the symbol actually is. So the question then is, if it was a symbol, why would Jesus use that symbol? And it's important to note that hell is often, I think 13 of the 23 times it's referenced in the Bible, the Greek word is Gehenna, and Gehenna was the town dump in Jerusalem. And so when Jesus is talking about hell, he says, listen, what's the worst possible thing you people have ever seen? It's the dump. And he says, it's like the dump, only worse. When you think about Gehenna, in our day and age, dumps are terrible, but you got paper products, you got plastic, you got people who threw away furniture, you got a broken TV here and there. If you go out there, you got rotting food, you might see a rat or two. But what was in a dump in first century Jerusalem? Paper products? No. Plastic? No. TVs? No. Broken furniture? No. What was the primary thing that would be in a dump in first century Jerusalem, outside of the city? Rotting animal carcasses. They kill animals inside. They eat animals. There's stuff you can't eat. There's the skin. There's the hooves. There's the horns. There's the, as Jed Clampett would say, the innards. Showing E. There's all this stuff. That was the primary thing thrown into the dump. So if you can just, don't even try to smell it. It's like, it's rotting animal carcasses on fire, trying to burn it. It looks like a lake of fire. Mark chapter 9 says that it's a place where the worm dieth not. And I think that's a picture of maggots. Really helping your appetite for dinner, aren't I? I mean, just picture this. Rotting animal carcasses, this probably as far as you can see in this hole, maggots all over the animal carcasses. They're eating and they're trying to burn it and think about the smell. Good grief. And Jesus, when he references hell, he calls it Gehenna. He says, you know, Gehenna, the dump of the universe, as bad as that is, hell's worse than that. You want to go there. Now, why is hell so bad? Physical pain? Perhaps. It might not be figurative. You better hope it's figurative. Again, because if it's not figurative, what it represents is worse. Why is it so bad? Why would hell be so bad? Well, one reason is because you are completely outside of the presence of God in hell. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 9 says that hell is out of the presence of God. Completely out of the presence of God. You've never been out of the presence of God. Wherever you've been in life, you've never been completely out of the presence of God. Because the Bible teaches that God is omnipresent. Psalm chapter 139 says, if you go to the highest heavens, he's there. If you go to the deepest grave, he's there. You've never entirely been out of the presence of God in your life. You may have run from God. You may have cursed God. You may have tried to get away from God. You have never been entirely out of the presence of God in your life. You have been out of relationship with God. He has hidden his face from you. You are not in a face-to-face relationship with God, but you have never been out of the presence of God in your life. Never have been. And that's why Christians talk about common grace. God, in his love and in his mercy, has given grace to every person, regardless of whether they are a follower of his or not. Christians teach about common grace. He makes the sun rise on the righteous and unrighteous. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. You've never been away from the grace of God in your life, regardless of how far you've gotten from it. You've never been completely out of his presence. That's why we teach, and one of the reasons why Christians, for instance, will go to maybe a doctor that's not a Christian. I mean, we don't huddle in our subculture. We may send our kids to a teacher who's not a Christian. We may hire a lawyer that's not a Christian. Aren't they all? No, I'm joking. That's a lawyer joke. Sorry, Bob Bailey. it's a joke. I meant to say politicians. Why would we go to a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher that's not a Christian? Because we believe that God gives grace. It's almost as though God has taken a handful of grace like a farmer takes a handful of seed and scattered it over the universe. And because of that, we believe that, the smartest doctor in town might not be a Christian. God gives grace. He gives wisdom. The smartest teacher in town may not be a Christian. God gives wisdom, and the greatest lawyer in town might not be a Christian. God gives grace. God gives mercy, regardless of whether a person is a follower of his or not. That's what Christians call common grace, and that's why we can do business with people that aren't Christian. That's why we can hire a president that might not be a Christian, but God has given them the grace. He has given them more wisdom than oftentimes the Christians have. You've never been apart from the grace of God. Even if you are not a Christian, he has given you wisdom. He has given you an intellect. God has bestowed upon you common grace that goes to all of humanity. One of the things about common grace is that he has withheld evil in this world. I mean, you say, how can that be? Look how evil the world is. I mean, this is a terrible world. Listen to me. It's not as terrible as it could be. Not as terrible as it could be. Inside of the human mind, and I know that there are some people who have very warped consciences, and there are some that you can say who have no consciences at all in very rare situations, which is debatable. But he has, for instance, given everybody consciences. Even though the people are bad, they're not as bad as they could be because of grace given. He's at least given people consciences. Now, they have warped them sometimes, but he has restricted evil in that way. I mean, listen, you could argue that in hell, you just have more freedom than you do in heaven. Some people say, you know, what's the old saying? Would you rather be a king in hell or a servant in heaven? I mean, just think about this. Think about hell as a place where you have finally the freedom to do what you want. Hell is a place of freedom, but everybody else gets to have the same freedoms you have. Wouldn't that be the definition of hell? I mean, listen, you go and you get to do whatever you want in hell, but so does Charles Manson and Hitler. And so does Osama bin Laden. See, there is a sense in which evil is restricted in the world. The very definition of hell would be to put everybody in the same place and say you're all free to do whatever you want to do. It would be like a prison without any guards or doors in it. There's a way in which God's presence has restricted evil. There's a way in which God's presence has restricted Satan in your life. Satan has not been able to do in your life what he would like to do in your life. And you say, he's ripped me to shreds. You don't know what he's done to my family. You don't know what he's done to my marriage. Listen to me. He hasn't done everything he'd like to do to you. Colossians chapter 2, Hebrews chapter 2 talks about how Satan has been defeated in a sense. Satan has been chained according to Colossians chapter 2. There's a sense in which what Christ did on the cross and even before that put Satan on a chain. He's like a junkyard dog, and if you get in his radius, he can do tremendous damage to you, but he is limited in what he can do if you'll stay out of his radius. And Satan has not done everything to you that he wants to do. Remember when he came into Jesus and said, give me Peter, I want to sift him like wheat. And he didn't get Peter. Remember when he came and he wanted Job and he wanted to kill his children and take his fortune and he wanted to bring him and to reduce him to nothing. And God said, I'm going to give you a chance to try him because he's a righteous man. Listen to me. That's what Satan would want to do to you. Satan has not done to you what he did to Job. He would if he could, but he hasn't because he has been restricted in this present age by the power and the presence of God. But hell is out of the presence of God. And so if hell is the absence of the presence of God, which 1 Thessalonians 1:9 says, what we're talking about then is that there really isn't common grace in hell. There isn't common grace in hell. You don't have the protections that God has afforded to you in this life against others and Satan himself. And that's worse than literal fire. That's worse than literal fire. I would rather be surrounded by literal fire than to be delivered into the hands of Satan for him to do whatever he wanted to do to me. It's the worst thing to have going on in your life. Hell isn't only just the absence of the presence of God, the absence of common grace. It's also the ultimate place of regret. Ultimate place of regret. I think it was F. Scott Fitzgerald who said, and I paraphrase, he said, there's not a worse place to be in life than to be in the midst of the difficult times and remember the good times. He said it better than that because he was a great writer. But he said, there's not a worse misery in life than to be in the middle of a miserable time and remember how things used to be, how good they used to be. That's an awful place to be. It's interesting that in the Bible, repeatedly, when it talks about hell, it's a place of outer darkness. And again, you know, figuratively, you can't have fire and darkness at the same time. But oftentimes, it's a place of outer darkness. And it's a place of weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. What does it mean to weep and wail and gnash teeth? What is that? That's a picture of people who are living with regrets. The weeping, the wailing. It's people who are overcome by regrets. And hell is the ultimate place of regret. Not only is hell the ultimate place of regret, but it's the only place in the world, in the universe, in the cosmos, wherever hell is, that is without hope. You've never been out of the presence of God. You've never been entirely without hope. As long as you have breath in this life, you got hope. As long as God is alive, you've got hope. You have never been entirely without hope in your life. But in hell, there would be no hope. It's an eternal place. There's no way to fix the mistakes you made in this life. There's no way to remedy the situation. And so it's a place without the presence of God, without God's common grace. The Bible says that it's also a place of ultimate regret. It's also a place without hope. Now, the Bible says ultimately we choose to go there. Ultimately we choose to go. It's interesting here that this man, and a lot of people point out, this rich man in hell never asked to get out. It's very interesting. He accuses Moses, or he accuses Abraham. He makes the claim that he didn't have enough information. But he never asks to get out. He never repents. He never confesses his sins. In fact, he thinks hell's a lot like life because he's still trying to order Lazarus around. Tell him to give me some water. Bring it down here. There's a sense in which, in spite of the torments, he doesn't want out. He doesn't repent. He doesn't confess. He makes would make no effort to even try to get out if he could get out. It's like C.S. Lewis said. He said, and famously he said, hell is a place with a locked door, but it's locked from the inside. It's locked from the inside. Why would people want to go to hell? If you were in hell, why would you want to stay? And the answer is because in human beings, we want freedom that much. We want freedom that much. See, God gives you and I two choices. He doesn't give you three, and we always want the third. There are two choices. One is to do it His way. The second is to do it our way. But the third He doesn't give us, which is for Him to do it our way. The two choices are you can do it my way or you can do it your way and suffer the consequences, but he doesn't say, or I'll do it your way. And what we want and what human beings tend to crave, and those who find themselves in hell are those who want freedom from God that much that they're willing to go. And ultimately, God says, you can have your freedom. I mean, there is a way to think about hell as it's like the ultimate success, right? That's what C.S. Lewis said. Hell is like the ultimate success for those who want freedom because their whole lives, they've been running from God. Their whole lives, they've resented God interfering in their lives. Their whole lives, they've resisted God telling them how to run their lives. Their whole lives, they've resisted the will of God, but His presence has been there. He hasn't completely removed Himself from their life. He still sends His Spirit to convict them, and they don't want to be convicted. They don't go to church. They don't want the conviction. They want to do life their way. They want to do life on their terms, and ultimately, they succeed. They get to go to hell. God finally says, you want your way that much, you can have your way. Ironic that it would be considered success, but it is success for those who ultimately want freedom. And you got to ask yourself, do I really want to run my life that much? Do I really not want God interfering in my life that much that I would get to the place where God says, thy will be done then? Thy will be done. You've got to ask yourself how important your freedom is, because ultimately hell is a decision about whether you want to be Lord of your own life at any cost. And that's the decision people make. People say, I'd never make that decision. People make that decision every day. People make that decision every day. You will meet people throughout your life that could have had a loving family, that could have been successful in life, that could have been well thought of, that could have done so much good in their life. But some of them are homeless. They live under bridges. because they wanted the freedom to put into their body what they wanted more than anything else. People choose living hells in this life every day. I was West Virginia on a mission trip, and we were back up in the mountains. It used to be coal country, but they don't have any industry now. Unemployment is tremendous. We go in, and we're a building team. We're a mission team. It's third world up in there. And I was talking to someone from that part of the country. He said, you know, it's really interesting, he said, because you look around and, you know, you get back up in there, the average lifespan is, you know, 10, 12, 15 years less than the average culture, than the rest of America. You don't really have good education. There isn't really any work up here. Drugs are really rampant. Houses are run down. You don't see many nice places to live. He said, you look at all this, and he said, I'm reminded, he said, when coal left this part of the country, and when coal left, no industry was going to come back up into these mountains. They can't build factories up in here. So we were basically headed to this place when coal left. He said, but the government came in and they offered anybody who wanted to take them up on it free housing out of the mountains in areas with good school districts and good jobs. They were offered a chance to leave. On the government dime, the government would sit them up in places where they could send their kids to good schools, give them work good jobs, live in nice houses. And he said they almost unanimously turned down the offer. They'd rather live in the familiarity of their mountains with bad schools, drugs rampant, poor housing, poor roads, no jobs, than to move down into the suburbs and begin life anew. Now you got to ask yourself the question, familiarity was more important to them than comfort. How important is your freedom? Do you want your way so badly? Do you want to be free from God so much that you would stand before Him one day and hear Him say, "Thy will be done then. If you don't want my presence, if you don't want me, thy will be done." Because that's the ultimate choice that we're making. And that's the choice that people make that determine their eternal destiny. Hell's a real place. It's a place that God doesn't want you to go. In fact, He sent His Son, Jesus Christ, to die on the cross so that you wouldn't have to go there. It's a real place. And it's a place that you ought to avoid at all costs. Will you stand with me? If you have something on your heart, something on your mind you want to come and pray about, these altars are open. And